squandered opportunity. It's practically cliche in our world today, and maybe seen no more clearly than the epidemic of drug and alcohol addiction that we find. A life full of promise and potential caught in the web of deception and slavery. All of us are aware, at least, of the fact that it happens, and many of us are touched personally by it. And yet squandered opportunity is found in other places as well, isn't it? Well, as I see the children of Israel on the outskirts of the Promised Land, and we see Moses in the book of Deuteronomy passionately teaching and reminding and repeating and reinforcing all that God is calling them to, all I can think of, because I do know the rest of the story, is squandered opportunity. I think it should be a lesson to us that we don't, in our own Christian lives, squander what God has made available to us in terms of all that He would provide and all that He would purpose. So even when we think about just the reality of how that affects lives here on earth, even greater how it affects us in terms of spiritual capacity, spiritual knowledge, all the things that God makes available to us, and just ask for our participation, ask for us to join Him in that. And basically, again, that is what Moses is doing in the book of Deuteronomy. So if you can turn to Deuteronomy chapter 11, that's kind of where we will be. Just bringing up that slide in chapter 10, just to remind us where we were last week in terms of all that God was instructing us. The one before that, just in terms of, remember these five verbs that are in chapter 10 of how God and Moses basically define the walk with God, that He calls us to fear Him, to walk in His ways, to love Him, to serve Him, and to observe His standards, to observe His laws. And again, those we saw last week, those are valuable things for us to think about as well. And then Moses follows those up with four different things he points to as the reasons why we would fear and walk and love and observe those things. And the four reasons, again, we saw this last week, that God is the highest authority and owns everything. He cares and condescends to us to make relationship with us. He is just. He does what is right, independent of any other influence. And again, He defends the defenseless. He defends the widows and orphans. Again, all the things that God is proclaiming about Himself that basically Moses is presenting to the people of Israel, say, you want to follow this God. You want to get to know Him. You want to set things aside in your life. You want to not think about yourself and what you want and what you're pursuing, and get on the track of this God in terms of relationship and following His will. Now that again finishes off chapter 10, and then as we delve into chapter 11, we see these things as far as what Moses is telling the people. And if you were to read Deuteronomy 11, by the way, and as I go through this very quickly, I encourage you to read these chapters. I encourage you to see the same things that I'm seeing. But what I'm most struck by in Deuteronomy 11 is how repetitive Moses is. How repetitive he has been through all these chapters saying, this is God. He's promised you the land. Just be faithful. Just obey. He's going to bless you. He's going to give you success. You're going to be able to overtake those armies and those cities that you're intimidated by. Just obey me. That's the constant restrain that has been happening through chapters 6 through 11. And so now for Moses to do the same thing in chapter 11, again, to me, just reinforces his passion, reinforces just the emphasis he's putting on, don't miss this. Again, don't squander this opportunity. The generation before you did that very thing. They were in the same place you were, and they weren't faithful. They didn't believe. They didn't trust God. Don't do the same thing. And so that's what Moses is communicating. And basically in the first seven verses, what he talks to them about is, remember that you kids have not seen all that you have. That basically, as you are now the adult generation going into the land, you have to remember there's a generation below you that has not seen what you have seen. They have not seen me as a God that I am. And basically he talks about the power that he's expressed in the life of the Israelites, the provision that he has made, and the discipline that they faced. I mean, one particular thing that he points to is there was a point in time where Korah, a Levite, rebelled against Moses and Aaron. And basically what he said was the Levite should be have a right to be priests as well, that it should not be an Aaronic priesthood, but it should be Levitical in terms of them having access to the priesthood. And so basically that was against God, and God judged them. As it says, the earth opened up and swallowed them. Again, and Moses is saying, remember that. Remember that you've experienced that. You've known God to be that type of God, affirming and assuring what he declares to be right and what standards he calls you to obey. And again, the reasons that we have to follow him is the kind of God he is, the power that he expresses, the provision he makes, but also the discipline that he puts forth to correct us and guide us in our life. And so basically, as he's telling this generation now, just make sure you tell your kids. Just make sure you're communicating that to the next generation. I mean, do you realize that automatically there is a lowering of conviction around people that are just hearing about an event rather than experiencing it? You know, that's what causes this generational lag, that people who come to Christ and they're enthusiastic about him, and basically now they're living out their lives, they're communicating to the younger generation, and the younger generation is just a little less passionate than that generation. And then they raise kids, and they're a little less passionate. And then the next generation is a little less passionate in terms of what they believe. And then what you have is you have a devolving of society and faith in God, because now you have a generation that, who's God? We don't even know who he is. We don't even care about what he thinks or what he's doing. And let me tell you, that's where we are. That's where we are in our country. That when I talk about my generation, we're like 4 and 5 generations from a strong generation living in the conviction of God. And now when my generation has communicated to our kids, again, the glory of God, the purpose of God, the vision of God, they just didn't get it. And so now they're having children, and those children now, this generation that's in sixth, you know, middle school or high school, has no clue about who God is. Because again, there's this generational drag that happens in faith. And what Moses is saying is, don't let that happen. As you've talked about what you've experienced and what you've seen, you have a knowledge of God and understanding of God that you have to cherish in terms of what you've been through. But then communicate that to your kids. Make sure you're living it out. I think part of it is, again, realizing you've got to tell your kids about it. Another part of it is conviction or accountability. Realize you're accountable to that information. Like, once you know something about God, once you understand that this is what he would desire of you or will or provide for you, and now you don't live in it, just realize there's a greater accountability in terms of your life. So those are the two things, again, that are happening in verses 1 through 7, where Moses just, again, reinforcing, your kids did not go through this, you did, so that means something. Now, what we find in chapter 11 is different phrases that are repeated that reinforce what Moses is talking about, and what we find is he did it is what is repeated. He did it. God accomplished. God worked. God did it. And again, it's that phrase, he did it, he did it, he did it, he did it, he did it. Again, all, you know, when he's talking about the events of the history, pointing to the God that accomplished that. Then basically in chapter 11, from verses 8 through 17, the land is the thing that is emphasized. The value and importance and the specialness, the unique nature of the land of Canaan in terms of what God's thoughts are about it, and the provision that God would seek to make through it. You know, basically, what we find here in terms of this, what God is talking about in terms of the land, is he is talking about the beauty of the land, the flowing of milk and honey, the blessing of the land, the bounty of the land, all the benefit. You know, the fact that the land right now is occupied by Canaanites and you need to come in, you need to take it over because that land is yours. I mean, basically, verse 18 is not that one, right? Yeah, so starting in verse 10, it says, "The land you are entering to take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you planted your seed and irrigated it by foot as in a vegetable garden. But the land you are crossing the Jordan to take possession of is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It is a land the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end." And what that verse there, I think, what is that, 11 or 12, verse 12 there, basically communicates a special value that God has over that land in Canaan. Now, I think the reason why that land is so special to God is He knows that, well, I think it is strategic in terms of what people communicate about its place in the geography of the world, but even more so knowing that that is a place where God is going to fulfill redemption history. To know that eventually Messiah would come to that area of the world. And so for God to regard that land in a special way and basically to communicate to the people, again, as Moses is talking about just what he's passing on to this next generation going to the land, is just how significant that land is to God and how dependent they need to be on Him for the land to do what God would intend. On first hand, it would be conquering the land, that you believe God and He'll give you victory, but that secondly, that God will continue to provide for the land. I mean, basically, that land of Canaan is a fairly arid land. I mean, basically, what he's saying about, you know, when you grow a vegetable garden in Egypt, it's different from growing a vegetable garden in Canaan. That basically you just kind of step on the ground and there's water there, probably from the, you know, the Nile River and the abundance of water that was there in that Nile Delta. But then to talk about Canaan, that's not going to happen. There's no dynamic coming from the ground that's supplying water. But what God is saying is, I'm going to supply it. See, the whole point is, I'm calling you to a land that requires rain so that you can be dependent on me for the rain you need to support your crops. I mean, how consistently do we know when we look at the stories that are in the Old Testament, how often drought was a means that God used to correct His people? And what I find interesting about that is if people knew the Word of God, if they knew Deuteronomy 11, they would just be able to say, wait a minute, God has stopped bringing rain. We've had droughts for several months. Huh, I wonder what God is doing. Duh! You must not be following the way that God called you to follow. Like He told you this was going to happen. You know, in some ways, for God to tell us what's going to happen, and then He does it, like, that's not His fault. Like, we can't, how dare you keep the rain from the people? Well, you told them, oh, follow me, obey my standards, do the things I would have you to do, build your relationship with me, and this is how I'm going to bless, and this is how I'm going to provide. And to have that physical representation, to have that thing that is, again, a physical way of affirming God's presence or His affirmation of the people following His will. Boy, did it rain today? Boy, did our crops get enough rain in order for them to grow? Well, you know something? We must be following God. We must be doing the things that He wants us to do. Then all of a sudden there's not rain and it's not happening. Ooh, you know, maybe I'm not following. I mean, wouldn't that kind of be nice? In terms of your life, the sun came up today, so God must be okay with us. The sun didn't, you know, not that. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice for God to keep that, like, moment-by-moment affirmation? Like, you know, if you've got tingles up your spine, that means you're following God and you don't have tingles. See, God doesn't do that because, again, He's calling us to a life of faith, a life of obedience based on doing what we know, not what we feel or what we're experiencing. But for the people of Israel, He's providing something physical. How can you know you're obedient? It's raining, and your crops are being provided for. But behind that, again, is this priority of that land, how special that is to God. I think there may be something in there that communicates even today the significance of that land. I think there are people, I think there are believers that go to extremes in terms of just how important that land is. They almost forget about the gospel and Jesus and the sovereignty of God in terms of things we have to do when we've got to get that mosque off the Dome of the Rock and we got, you know, something. Do what God would have you do, and then let him take care of all the rest in terms of what he's going to coordinate, what he's going to orchestrate. But to recognize still that there's something special about that land to God. And he's communicating that here in Deuteronomy chapter 11. So basically, because God is saying all this, again, you're the generation that's experienced it. The next generation hasn't. Make sure you tell them. Make sure you're accountable to that. Realize the land he's bringing you to is blessed. It's going to provide for you. But again, you've got to be faithful to me in order for rain to come. So therefore, the conclusion is found in verse 18. It says, "Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your heads and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home and when you walk down the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give your forefathers, and many as the days that the heavens are above the earth." And so does this sound familiar? Moses said the same thing in Deuteronomy 6. And see, that's kind of my point, that Moses is just repeating himself. To me, it's not, I don't think it's because Moses is senile. Oh, I don't remember I said this a few chapters ago. Because this is a message that Moses is presenting to the people. This, it might be over a few days, but this is not Moses writing a letter and I write one chapter and then 3 weeks later I write another chapter. This is Moses communicating a message to the people. So he is intentional about what he is reinforcing and to recognize how important it is for you've got to be in the Word, you've got to know the Word, you've got to know the standards, you've got to know what I've communicated to you and surround yourself with it. Make sure that it's a constant, the thing that's constantly reinforced in your life. And that's what it's going to take. That's what it's going to take to follow me and be faithful in the way that I'm desiring for you to be faithful. It's actually interesting in verse 29, let me read 26 through 28 just because it's on the slide there, but then we'll go on to 29. "See, I'm sending before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today. The curse if you disobey the commands of the Lord your God and turn from the way that I command you today by following other gods which you have not known. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you're to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessing and on Mount Ebal the curses." And so what's interesting in terms of, again, a teachable moment that God is calling the people to is that once they're in the land, there's these two mountains that are kind of side by side, and there's a valley in between. And so what Joshua actually does with the people is he takes certain tribes and puts them on one mountain, other tribes on another mountain, and basically when Joshua and the leaders and the priest stand in the middle in the valley, and when they proclaim the blessings, the people on the mountain for the blessing mountain, they applaud and they praise God in terms of their worship of God. And then when he declares the curses, the people on the other mountain, they applaud that, you know, God is reinforcing that truth. They're not wishing or desiring the curses, but they're recognizing that God gives both blessing and cursing to teach us. Because we need both. We need to be told what's going to happen if you do this. We need to be told what's going to happen if you don't do this. I mean, before God does anything, he always tells us what he's doing and why he's doing what he's doing. And so when God is communicating this to the people, again, it's all reinforcing all that Moses has been passionately talking to the Israelites. Get to know God. Get to know his word. Follow the commands. Follow the decrees. Recognize the God of promise. Recognize the God of power. Recognize the God that's calling you to believe. Believe him not only for the way he'll give you victory in the land, the way he'll provide you for the land, but also believe him for the law you'll follow, how you orchestrate your life and what you do in terms of how you behave and how you represent him on the earth. And so basically a very important transition happens between Deuteronomy 11 and Deuteronomy 12. Basically what Moses has done is he's taken the first five chapters of Deuteronomy and done a history lesson. Basically, he's reminded the people of all the things that they went through that, again, encourages faith, that causes them to be drawn to God. In chapters 6 through 11, he basically gives the why. It's the passionate communication. This is why you want to follow this God. This is why you want to listen to the law and obey it. Then basically 12 through 26, he's going to give them the law. He's going to give them the standards. So it's kind of a good message, right? In other words, before I tell you what God asking you to do, let me remind you about how this past generation dealt with all this stuff. Then let me tell you all the reasons why you should follow God in terms of, again, the power, the provision, the land, all these different things. And now, basically, from 12 to 26, he's going to give them the law. And so, basically, moving on to chapter 12, this is what we have. That basically, the main point of Deuteronomy 12 is you must not follow the pattern of worship the Canaanites follow. Don't follow the pattern of worship the Canaanites follow. And in verses 1 through 3, he talks about them destroying their high places. You know, recognizing the power that these idols would have on the people of Israel, basically said you've got to eradicate the land of that. You've got to destroy them all, turn them over, break them down, bust them up, whatever it is in terms of just addressing that. Get them out of the land. 4 through 7, this is a very important part of Deuteronomy 12, says that God will establish an exclusive place of worship. I mean, that's the refrain of Deuteronomy 12, that there's going to be one place that God's going to establish as a place of worship. And Israel was going to be called to bring all the offerings, all their sacrifices to that place. Now, I think there's a couple things that reinforces for us. That basically, when we're talking about the worship of God, as we're talking about following him, we don't ask God to meet us where we are or do things on our terms. Rather, we go where God says he is, and we meet him on his terms. That's the message of Deuteronomy 12, and that's a message that translates law, grace, church, Jews, whatever, in terms of just what God would communicate to all of us, in terms of that we don't tell God how we're going to worship him. We learn from God how he is to be worshipped, and then we worship in that way. Like, we don't say, you know, well, God, I want to worship you like this. Well, you know, and maybe that this is something opposed to the word. I want to worship you by beating people up. You know, there's actually a doctor who performs abortions and says, I'm doing God's will by doing abortions. Okay? And so, what could be a more graphic expression of someone thinking, hey, this is what I do to glorify God? Well, guess what? If God doesn't say that glorifies him, if you're not in the, oh, you know, this is a more common thing that happens. People say, well, you know, so I don't feel like I need to go to church to worship God. Yeah, you can worship him at the beach, and you can worship on the mountains. But you know something? Church is something God has established as a place for people to gather, to grow, to build relationship, to edify, and to learn and work together in terms of fulfilling the purposes of God. I mean, all the things that God would intend for the church, God would call people to be involved, to be here, to be present. Again, don't think, well, I can worship. Yeah, of course you can worship God other places, but this is a primary place you should worship him. This is a place that shouldn't be secondary on the agenda, secondary in the schedule. It should be something that's primary in the schedule, because that's what God has ordained. So you want a lesson from Deuteronomy 12? That's what God... Now, it doesn't have to be this church. I hope it's this church, particularly if you've been here for a while. But you know, the beauty of Jesus is there's not one location. There's literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of locations. But you do need to choose one and be committed to it. in terms of what God would seek to establish through a body of Christ, consistency is one of the most essential parts of that. That we can't develop what God would seek to develop in us or in a body of believers outside of people being present and available to each other. But so again, I think that's the first thing that God saying this one place to worship. You know, when in all of Israel, you're going to go into this promised land, you're going to be scattered more than you're scattered right now, but there's going to be one place for you to go to. I think, again, that causes them to think, it's not me who decides how I worship God, it's God who determines how I worship Him. But then secondly, it also reinforces the singularity of God. You know, God, you know, the Israelites were, involved in a world that had pantheons of gods, that they would have different high places and different high places in different areas because, hey, this is where you worship Baal, this is where you worship Asherah, this is where you worship this other Canaanite god, and they have different locations reinforcing to them there are different gods. And so another thing that God is saying, that there's one place to worship, is I am one God, that God is one, and you worship me in a different way than the Canaanites have. So again, that's one place of worship is what chapter 12 is all about in terms of what he's reinforcing. Verse 8 actually says it won't even be like the way they've done it while they're wandering. You know, while they're wandering, they're basically in the same location. So therefore, as they're bringing their sacrifices to the tabernacle, that tabernacle is moving with them. So it's fairly convenient for them to come and worship God and bring their tithes and offerings to Him. And so God is saying, Moses is saying, God is communicating through Moses, that even their worship of God won't be the same as what they're experiencing. That when God brings them in the promised land, it's going to be one place. And by the way, that place is Shiloh. When they first enter the land, the tabernacle is established. It does have a consistent place at Shiloh. We can tell the story because we're running out of time of, you know, where it goes from there, but that's where it is established. And so God is just setting down rules about how they act when that is in a singular location. Now, a refrain that happens consistently through the chapter in terms of chapter 12 is, hey, you know something? If you want to eat meat, realize you can eat meat anytime you want, as much as you want. But if you're slaughtering animal to eat it, it's fine. You can do that wherever. But if you're slaughtering animal in an offering and a worship of God, that's where you have to be in that single place. That's where you have to be in that place that God establishes. I mean, something we have to remember about the sacrificial system in the Old Testament, what the Jews participated in, is that certain sacrifices were completely dedicated to the Lord. That you bring the animal, it's slaughtered, it goes to God and God alone. Other sacrifices, some goes to God, some goes to the priests. And that's what that sacrifice is. Then, some sacrifices go to God, go to the priest, and then come back to the giver. And so therefore, there's actually like a fellowship, community aspect to the sacrifices. So basically what people could say, and I think what Moses is addressing about, hey, if you want to just have meat and join with your family and friends eating meat, again, if it's not for sacrifice, if it's not about making an offering, do it wherever you want. But once it's for offering, because to the Jews, part of that sacrificial system was, hey, you know something? I'm going to go make sacrifices to God. Come along with me. There's going to be extra, too much for my family. Bring your family along. Maybe you'll bring an offering too. I mean, realize the worship of God in the tabernacle, yeah, I mean, was a connecting and a binding thing for the Jews. Like, all of them were supposed to be doing what they're supposed to be doing. So they're all supposed to be bringing tithes and offerings and sacrifices and seeking forgiveness and providing for the Levites and all the different things that God would be calling them to do. So when everyone realizes they're on the, hey, you go to the tabernacle today? You taking that trip to Shiloh? Well, let's take it together, and let's have a family reunion, or let's have a community event where we're going to Shiloh, and we're going to be making our sacrifices. And by the way, you know, part of those sacrifices are going to come back to us, so we'll have a grand old party. I mean, it really does communicate about our God that he's not just about our relationship with him, he's also about our relationship with each other. That God is pleased. Your family eats together. The church eats together. We share a meal together. There's nothing that, you know, I mean, food is something, food and relationship go very well together in terms of what the world internalizes as well as what God communicates. And that's really what is communicated when he talks about you can slaughter an animal anywhere in chapter 12. If you read that, that is always about it's not for sacrifice, it's not for offering, because of the fact that certain offerings would be about them. Hey, you know something? I'd really like some meat tonight. Ever get in that mood? I want a nice steak. You know, I'm going to have some chicken tonight or whatever. You know, so therefore you're in the mood for meat. And so therefore, what they would say is, you know, I've got this bull. And you know something, I could sacrifice this and I could have my family eat it, my friends eat it in the community. Or what I could do is I could make a fellowship offering to God and recognize my appreciation for him providing me this bull. And so therefore, I'm going to kill the bull. I'm going to give God part of it. The priests are going to get part of this. But then I'm going to receive some of it too. And so therefore, my need is being addressed in the presence of God's desire being addressed. And that's the neat picture of what Deuteronomy is communicating, again, about the single place of worship. Let me just close out the chapter by just expressing... just realize how much better Jesus is. He's particular about worship. He's particular about the kind of people we're becoming. You know, all those things, but... You know, the fact that we access God any moment of any day, the fact that you're on vacation and you're in Florida and, hey, we can find a church here, and the church still is. That's the place of worship. It is the church, but, hey, I'm in Florida. It could be that church. And I'm in Oklahoma. It could be that church. Jesus is much better in terms of just geographics don't matter. In terms of there being that single location, certainly his salvation is greater as well. But chapter 12 closes out I've lost my okay, let's just go with don't eat the blood. You hate when there's... It wasn't that. It wasn't the blood. Thanks for the help, though. I know it's on the screen, but there's something that wasn't on the screen. And that is, basically, if you're far away and taking the bull to Shiloh is too much, what you can do is you can sell the bull where you are, get the cash... Bring the cash to Shiloh, buy a bull, and then sacrifice it like that. So God cares about logistics. And so that's what Then, in addition, the other thing that chapter 12 talks about is the blood. And so verses 23 through 25, it says this, but be sure not to eat the blood, because the blood is the life, and you must not eat the life with the meat. You must not eat the blood poured out on the ground like water. Do not eat it so that it may go well with you and your children after you, because you will be doing what is right in the eyes of the Lord. Again, a standard that God has, that I don't think it means we don't eat rare meat, but I think it is for the Israelites recognizing just what blood was supposed to represent to them. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And so basically the sacrificial system established, there's a purpose and a expression for blood. There's a problem solved. There's an issue addressed by virtue of blood being in the sacrifice. And I want to sanctify that. I think that's the point in Deuteronomy 12 here. I want to sanctify your understanding of what is blood for. Blood is representing the life given that compensates for sin. And if the wage of sin is death, then life has to be provided for that debt, for that sin to be compensated for. Again, if the wages of sin is death, then a life needs to be given for that sin to be compensated for. And in the Old Testament, that life, that provision, was an animal, but the blood was a sign of him giving the life. Like, how do you know that the animal was giving his life? Because the blood came out. That's where the life is found. And it's funny how science today shows us that, you know what? Life really is in the blood in terms of all the things that God has established there. So we'll end there, pick it up next week in terms of our study of Deuteronomy. Father, we just do thank you that you're a God that does things on purpose, that you welcome us to join you in those purposes that you have, the standards you would have us keep in terms of being your people. And even though that is not riddled with as much law as we find here in Deuteronomy, when we think about what you call us to in spirit, in power, in conviction from your word, in the example of Christ, Father, I just pray that even as we study what you're communicating to the Israelites, we would see the same things you're calling us to in terms of the conviction and the knowledge that drives us to that truth, and the accountability we have to be the people that you've called us to be. And so, Father, continue to answer and reinforce that in our lives, even as we study the book of Deuteronomy. It's in your Son, Jesus Christ's name, that we do pray. Amen.